Hello. Thanks for checking in to this repeat performance of a stage's conversation I recorded with the divine Jacqueline Dark in April 2019. Jackie's passing is a terrible shock and sadness that we all share. A consummate artist who had so much more to give her audience across many platforms, opera, musical theatre and cabaret. Jackie commanded a stage with an exquisite presence, an extensive skill set and an elegant humanity. Her stage presence was such because of her love of life and all that she encountered in it. Her generosity of spirit and laughter and kindness touched so many people. I knew Jackie for several decades, meeting her in community theatre productions in Ballarat. Jackie excelled in the operetta of the Gilbert and Sullivan canon, featured annually during the Begonia Festival. She turned her focus to straight plays too, giving a delicious Nora in Neil Simon's Brighton Beach memoirs. And I watched mesmerised at every performance of Godspell as she delivered the passionate By My Side. She excelled in theatre restaurant and music hall, presented at the Victoria Theatre, Sovereign Hill. Cheeky, dedicated, warm, witty and possessed of the most magnificent voice, Jackie was destined for far bigger stages. And she conquered them all. Condolences to all of Jackie's colleagues, family and friends. We have lost a giant talent and a superhuman being. The Wizard of Oz remarks to the Tin Man on his departure from Oz. And remember, my sentimental friend, that a heart is not judged by how much you love, but by how much you are loved by others. Vale, Jackie Dark. And now, here's the unedited stages episode recorded in April of 2019 with Jackie Dark. Jacqueline Dark grew up in Ballarat, Victoria, a precinct that fosters participation in the arts and hosts a collection of community theatre companies, choirs and orchestras, all with the intent to practice excellence and provide opportunity and experience to the enthusiastic novice. A youth spent performing in amateur musicals, theatre restaurant and operetta afforded Jackie an opportunity to play and discover the power of performance. Standing out as a dynamic talent, it seemed imperative that she would be called to a career in vocal performance and the stage. After completing a Bachelor of Physics degree, she gave the classroom a brief stint, but the urge to perform professionally propelled her to the opera studio at the Victorian College of the Arts, where she graduated with first-class honours. Roles in musical theatre and opera followed, along with a swag of awards, all confirming Dark as a practitioner of note. Her performance experience also encompasses cabaret and the concert platform, all handled with aplomb and easy calibration. But perhaps her most significant role is that of mother, a role she pursued in her early 40s. Incidentally, another role as mother came along shortly after by way of a revival of The Sound of Music. I've known Jackie for several decades. There is always a lot to catch up on. It is a great joy to be in her company. She radiates warmth and wisdom. We commenced our chat in a galaxy not so far away at the beginning.
So thanks for doing this.
You're welcome.
It's nice
see you.
It's nice to see you after so long.
After 100 years.
100 years. Well, not quite 100 years, but it's getting up there.
I know.
Do you remember getting your equity card, your actor's equity card, and what were the circumstances around that?
Oh, my goodness.
Because I'm happy to jolt your memory if you can't.
Do you know, really?
We did it together.
Auditions for Les Mis?
Yes.
Yes! I was so young. Oh, my God. What were
well,
we
I think
thinking?
I was about 19.
We were teenagers,
so
yeah.
So you must have been 18.
Yeah.
And Les Mis was auditioning. It must have been that very first production, wasn't it?
Yes, and you couldn't get an audition if you didn't have...
You had to be an equity
You had
member.
To be a member.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So fortunately, I'd been doing some commercials.
Yes.
At the local TV station, and you'd been doing singing gigs, I think.
Something.
And all that sort of thing.
I was doing piano bar in a nightclub.
Yeah.
At about 15, remember?
So that was enough to get us an equity card, I think. And then you and I and your brother tootled
That's
down
right.
to
we went together.
Melbourne to the audition. It must have been
in
an
warehouse.
Open
audition. Was it in MTC or something? It feels like, in my memory, it's some kind of warehousey situation. It's something quite industrial.
It was something like that. I mean, and we didn't have agents, of course. God, so it must have been just have turn been up and sing.
Shocking.
Do you remember what you did?
Not in the least. Probably. I have no idea. Do you?
I have no idea why. Probably because it was so disastrous. But I went in and did reviewing the situation because I thought I might have been a
Thénardier, of course,
candidate. And I finished. I'd given it all the best Fagin
everything
I could.
Everything you had.
And they looked at me and they said, "Oh, and you came all the way from Ballarat." And I said, "Yeah, thank you."
Wow. Wow.
I'm reading some subtext there.
Yeah, anyway. I didn't know. I don't even think that I got that. I just think I kind of went in mousy and quiet and just, you know.
But look at you now.
Look at me now, brassy as get up.
Where did you grow up?
In Ballarat in Victoria.
And did you enjoy that?
Sunny Ballarat. Not often sunny. It is freezing. I always thought people were being sooks when they came from Melbourne and said, "Oh, it's so cold here." And then after living in Melbourne and visiting home, it was like, "Oh God, it really is freezing, isn't it?" I loved it because, I mean, the one thing about Ballarat, as someone who was passionate about singing, is there's such a massive opportunity or number of opportunities for anyone to do that in that city. It's just a city full of the arts. It's got so many amateur theatre groups. It's got South Street. It's got, you know, so many amazing coaches and teachers, and they really care about theatre in that city. So I think, you know, I was very lucky to come from there.
Now, I should tell our listeners that we're under the flight path at the moment.
Yes, so, we are.
So we might get the odd
trip conducting to an interview in the flight desk.
Sydney to LA, going over. So it was good. So you, of course, embraced the opportunity to perform very regularly.
Yes,
with the local
anywhere I could.
Amateur companies.
Opening of an envelope, I would sing absolutely anywhere I could. Loved it.
Including not only musicals, but operetta. You know, there was the annual Begonia Festival, and they featured a lot of operetta.
Brilliant shows. You know, Barry Wilkins, which is where I met the brilliant Hugh Halliday. And the first time he directed me, I was like, wow, this is something. I think it was his first one was Iolanthe. And I did it before Madonna. I had a silver. And if anyone who knows my body type would like to imagine me in a silver all over shiny body stocking with pointing triangular bosoms.
Cone-esque.
You look cone-esque. Yeah, yes, so I did those. My nickname was Tin Tits in the show, as I recall.
Oh.
Yeah.
I don't know whether Gilbert or Sullivan would...
I think they'd appreciate it. I've never lived it down. Anyone who saw the show has never let me forget. Oh, and massive, like, stiletto boots. I looked quite the sight.
Do you remember the first show that you did?
In Ballarat?
Yeah, well,
yeah,
whatever,
ever,
really.
Yeah.
What ignited your passion?
Ballarat Light Opera Company.
So, because they had a children's.
Yes, a children's.
As well.
Yeah, the Block Juniors. I always wanted to be a singer, but I used to go around thinking, I just want to sing and I don't know how I can do this. Can I, you know, I didn't want to really sing in a band and I was too young anyway. I was looking at all these things. I didn't know musicals really existed. And then I went and saw a friend who was in Hans Christian Andersen, which was the Block show the year before. And I just went, oh my, what is this mysterious, wonderful world I've never experienced or heard of? That's what, I just went home. I remember going home and saying, that's what I want to do. How can I do that next year? And I was too nervous to audition and self-conscious to audition for the chorus. So luckily my mum knew John Stutchbury, who was the director. She rang up and said, look, do you just need bodies in the chorus that can go in without auditioning? And he let me just be in the chorus without having to sing in front of anyone, because I wouldn't have had the confidence to do that. So he just let me be in that, and gradually, like singing with that group of people, I got little bits, tiny bits of confidence, and it kind of spiraled from there.
Do you remember that the feeling of that first night with an orchestra and with an audience?
Yeah.
And how did that make you feel?
Oh, absolute tingles. And telling a story, like just the feeling of getting a reaction to be on the stage for the first time and hear them laughing or hear them clapping or just responding to something you've done. It's like there really is this mystical connection between a performer and the audience. It's a real thing and it's a tangible thing that happens, and that's why we all do it. That's what I'm, you know, unless you do it for ego, which is, you know, fairly shallow and obvious. But if you do it for that, it's the most magical thing when it happens, and it's glorious. Yeah.
So you had probably a good decade doing amateur shows.
Yes.
Yeah. How do you think that prepared you for what was going to be your future career
as a performer? Incredibly well, I think. And after becoming a professional singer, you see people come in who haven't done that, and they don't know stage right, stage left, prompt, OP. They don't know like the just simple things that you and I, because I know you've done a lot of theatre before you did pro theatre, and just things like not standing in front of people. You know, don't block your colleagues.
Basic stagecraft.
Yeah, you know, basic stagecraft. You know, don't face up stage unless you've been told to, unless there's a reason. Yeah, you know, just the stuff you learn, and after 10 years of doing amateur, lots of amateur stuff, you just take for granted. So it's just a massive amount of stuff you don't have to think about when you go pro. You can just think about character and voice and all those, concentrate on all that stuff you need to.
The thing I loved about it too was not only that basic stagecraft as a performer, but you had the opportunity to experience different roles, whether you wanted to sort of have a go at makeup or props, or it gave you a real appreciation.
A playground of, and also learning how to behave, learning, you know, there are certain, some people have certain personalities in theatre and you learn very quickly how to deal with that and how to not be that. And, you know, that you really learn how to respect fellow performers, and everyone has a different way of getting through a show. And you see, you know, 10 versions of that, and you learn, oh, that's that kind of performer. Okay, this is what they need. They need to be left alone, or okay, they need lots of support, or they. So you learn really how to work with your colleagues, which is a fantastic thing, because, you know, one of the joys of theatre is that gypsy tribe of family we get. And I've been lucky enough to work with incredible people, and they're now all still part of my life, and they are our little family wherever we go in the world. And that's because this gorgeous little group of hearts has all banded together and supported each other. And you know, we're still mates, because that's what it's about, really.
We did a famous production of Godspell. Do you remember that?
Yes, infamous, I would say.
Infamous. Yes. Look, and I remember, you know, eight times a week, which was hysterical because we did 10 performances.
Yes. 8 shows a week for a week and a half.
Falling in love with your voice.
Oh, I mean, bless
it
you.
It was the most magnificent voice, certainly musical theatre voice at that stage.
Oh, bless.
Which was great. You sang the...
I fell in love with your acting, so there, it's mutual admiration.
Oh, not my voice. It was a musical, Jackie.
Oh, love.
The Pebble testing. In the Shoe song. But we got letters to the local newspaper.
We did. And remember, we all got the flu, and there was one performance out of the 11 that we had to cancel because we'd put on everyone up and to and including the director of the show. And, you know, the stage manager had gone on, and then everyone was so sick that we had to cancel the show. And they said, you know, the devil has felled the production because they're so anti-God and they're all heathens. Well, all right. We're like, no, it's actually because we were all drinking out of that thing as we passed it around in the Last Supper and everyone got sick,
that's
remember?
Right. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But it was astounding that people took objection to this fabulous 70s musical, Broadway musical, which we were doing.
It was great, may I say. You know, it was a great show, great cast. I still remember that as one of the highlights of my career of things that I've done. It was amazing.
Who were your idols when you were growing up, as performing idols or vocalists?
Wow. Well, I didn't know opera, so it wasn't opera people. It was music theatre people. Certainly, you know, Deb Byrne, I loved. Mainly people who really connected with the audience. And, you know, as a little kid going to see her in things like Cats and Les Mis, she was one person who... Every time she sang, it was honest and there was sincerity and you could just feel her heart, like, just beating in her hand. You know, it was just people like that. Maria Mercedes, Philip Gould, Anthony Warlow, of course, all of those famous music theatre.
Because, I mean, when we were, you know, late teenagers, early 20s, that, you know, that was that explosion in the 90s of musicals like Cats and...
Yeah.
And Les Mis and Phantom and those musical theatre performers.
The big ones. And Quast, oh my God.
Yeah, and they were all putting out CDs. You know, Marina had a CD, Deb Byrne had a CD.
And they made stars out of them all. Yeah. They all became absolute superstars. Yeah.
And that's something which probably isn't, we don't have today.
No, not so much. And I think it was a conscious promotion too, which I think music theatre does well. I have to say, they, when I did Sound of Music, I'd never, you know, experienced going into Bourke Street Mall and seeing a massive poster of me, you know, in the middle of the mall. I was like, what is this? And, you know, when we went to Brisbane, there were flyers of me all down South Bank, which, and they have your name on it. Like, it's not just a photo of you in a role or something, which is still gorgeous when they take photos of the actual performers. I love that. But they also had everyone's names up. So I think I love that. I love promoting Australian talent. Of course I do. And I think there can be more of that in general. Because I think that's when people go. It's like the movies. They see someone's name. If you see Anthony Warlow's name or Marina's name, people will go, oh, Marina's in that. I'm going to go.
Yeah. We look at Evita, this recent season of Evita. Tina. You know, it's sold out because of Tina Arena.
Yeah. Mm. And if you make those names, if you call them, people will come. It's people love following, and there is a real loyal following in Australia for Aussie performers. And I just think we need to make some stars out there, and I think it would work. I know there's, you know, I'm not a producer. Maybe it wouldn't. Maybe I know nothing. Who knows?
Who knows? So at the end of your secondary schooling, you pursue a very sensible career.
Yes.
And you go off to uni and you've got a qualification to fall back on. What did you study?
I've got a Bachelor of Physics and a Grad Dip of Education. So I taught physics and maths for a while.
How long did you teach?
7 or 8 years. And then I started kind of going part-time and doing professional shows. And then I got offered more of them. So they kind of took over. And
did you enjoy teaching?
Loved it. Absolutely loved it. It was the same thing that I enjoy now that I do, like, if I can help someone with auditions or something like that. Often people will come to me, and when I was doing musicals, people would often come and saying, look, I'm having trouble with this phrase. How do I fix this? What, you know, can you give me some little fix for this? And they'd often be really simple things. And just watching their face light up and go, oh my God, I've struggled with that for a year, and now this tiny little thing has fixed it. And it was like, yes! And I love that. I love teaching physics when you'd be explaining some concept, and one by one, kind of at different point. I mean, kids learn differently, and just see their faces light up as it's like, oh, I get it. I get why this works. And I remember having that feeling myself, because I was taught by the extraordinary Lynn Kelly, she's the reason I did physics. She was my year 11 physics teacher, and she was so inspirational, and she made me love it so much. And I still love it. People say, I hate physics or I hate maths. It's like, well, because you had a dud teacher, and it's hard to get physics and maths teachers, so they put people in who don't love it or don't know it themselves that well. So how are kids going to love it if they're taught by someone who's kind of struggling to impart it? Whereas I would go in, like, I did a little bit of, you know, emergency, we call it emergency teaching in Victoria, they call it casual teaching here. Yes, yes. And I'd say, you know, I want to do some emergency. Like, what even is that? Like, is that like CPR or C3PR, as my child calls it? But yeah, and I would go in, and whatever class it was, I'd end up talking about quantum physics, and the kids would all come back going, I asked my dad last night about, you know, the double slit diffraction, and I'm like, yes, you did. Good on you.
Because, of course, mathematics is a good grounding for any good musician.
Yeah, maths and music really go together. People get shocked that I do the two, but they're so similar in so many ways, and it's a similar kind of processing part of your brain that does. Music is so mathematical, whereas the actual performance side is the opposite. It's, you know, instinctual and emotional, but the actual learning of it is very mathematical, especially some modern pieces.
So what about, you know, I must admit, I was surprised as well, not because I didn't think you could do it, but it just came out of left field. But
where are you going? Well,
your pursuit of an operatic career. You know, I recognise that you had this fantastic musical theatre voice, but all of a sudden it was extended into the field of opera.
I know.
When did you discover that you had that potential in your voice?
I remember people, because I loved music theatre. As soon as I discovered it, I just went and listened to it all, and that is my first love. I loved it. I was never a great belter. Like, I'm a better belter now than I was then, but I always had this more classical sounding voice. And I remember when people said, one of my mum's friends at the time said, oh, you know, I've heard your voice, you should look at opera. And I was like, what? How insulting. How dare you? What are you talking about? I'm a music theatre singer. How very dare you? And it hadn't really crossed my mind. I started learning classically because I wanted to be better. So I was learning classical technique quite late. But loving it and loving that I could do things that I couldn't do before. But then the more I did that, the more I felt like when I was singing in that classical style, I always felt when I was trying to do belting and stuff that there was more there that just wasn't opening up. And then it was the classical technique that suddenly I was singing stuff that was effortless and this big sound coming out. I was like, ah. And then our mutual friend Jason Wosley applied for the Victorian College of the Arts Opera Studio, which at the time ran a part-time course, which was 3 nights a week in Melbourne. So 3 nights, 6 till 10. I think it was Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And you got a diploma of opera. I got a grad dip of opera because I already had a degree. And it was utterly incredible. It was really performance-based. He said, you should go and audition for that. And of course, I had nothing really to sing. So I went and sang something from Samson and Delilah in English instead of French. And I think at that stage, they only took 6 to 8 people a year. So over the 3 years, it was only, 18, 20 people. And out of that, they would cast all of the operas and all of the scenes they performed. So it was a tiny pool of singers getting massive amounts of experience. And it was really elite. And I didn't think for a second I'd get in. And then they rang and said, you're in. And I thought, oh, man. And I was teaching full time. So I talked to the school and I said, look, I'm going to be going down 3 nights a week. Are you okay with this? And they said, as long as you can still do. And I was young and obviously full of energy because I taught.
It's amazing what you can do.
Yeah, taught physics, maths full time, drove from Melbourne to Ballarat, which is about an hour 15, 3 nights a week, and did this course and all that entailed, and loved every second of it.
What does the course teach you? What sort of things did you study?
I did language. I did French, German, Italian. We did drama. We did movement, dance, all different sorts of dance. We did stuff like, we did specialty subjects too. We did, some mime. We did some, I remember we did a mask workshop where we had to, which was great because it was actually about learning to act without using your face. So everything had to be in your body. You would know as a actor, everything had to be in your body. So you, without using facial expressions, you had to express everything you were feeling through physical stuff. So I found that really fascinating. Gosh, what else did we do?
Because of course the form is not just the voice.
Yeah.
You've got to look the part and follow the psychology of the character and all that.
Yeah, which is what interests me. Like, I have no interest in just standing there and singing. And in fact, in watching, I'd much rather watch someone who's a bit rough and is giving it 100% and means it and breaks my heart than someone who sings a pitch perfect, technically proficient thing that just leaves me.
and I guess that's why, a lot of opera fans sort of like Callas more so than Sutherland because she was able to act.
I think Sutherland could act too, but I know exactly what you're saying, that the old, what we call it in opera is park and bark, has kind of had its day. I think there was a place for that, but I think now, certainly, I mean, some people love that. Some people just go for the voices.
For the oral experience. Yeah.
Which I completely understand because that's the thing opera has. That's our point of difference.
Yeah.
Like the voices, and they're unamplified, and there's something visceral about hearing an unamplified voice if you're used to hearing musicals and things. I remember when we were rehearsing Sound of Music and everyone, when I first sang, they're like, oh, it's just a different sound. They're like, oh, that sound is, we haven't heard that before.
Well, how do you produce that volume? That's all comes from the support of the diaphragm.
And breath.
Are some people, can you be taught that? Or
you can be taught it.
It's a gift that some people have.
I think physiologically you've got to be predisposed to having a bigger voice. It doesn't have to be a huge voice, but it has to have, what you can learn is the ability to make it carry better. So you can certainly learn a technique to, give it focus and give it a core and give it, singer's formant, as we call it, which is that the ping that gets it across the orchestra. And you can learn that stuff. But the size of your voice is genetic. And, you can change it a certain amount. But, the basic voice you have is your voice. And that's where people get into trouble if they try to sing things that are too big or, you know, the wrong style that, you know, there are things that we'd all love to sing, but you've just got to say, oh no, I'm not touching that. I'm lucky I was born with a more dramatic voice because that's my personality. Like, I love those roles. I love dramatic, you know, and I love playing bad girls. If I had been born with a soubrette voice, which is those little pretty soprano, you know, who play all the gorgeous farm girls and things, I don't know what I'd do.
Well, that's right. Your vocal type, I suppose, predisposes you to certain characters.
Roles, of course. Yeah.
So what vocal type are you?
It's been debated for my whole career.
Right.
I'm nominally a mezzo-soprano, which is the middle. There are contraltos which don't really exist so much. They're very, very rare. And those, you know, those lower old singers that were really low and resonant. But a mezzo is kind of, you know, your middle. And then sopranos are at the top. And within those, there are variations. Like, there are some that are light, like, you know, dramatic ones heavier, lyric ones lighter, coloratura does the runs and stuff. But I'm a high mezzo, so there is speculation that I may be a soprano that just needs to try harder.
You're coming out of Ballarat too. I have to say that it's extraordinary the amount of opera singers.
Yeah.
Who we've seen, you know, people like Elsie Morrison, Marie Collier, the Lemkes, you know, David and Roger, David Hobson. Natalie Jones. Is it something in the water?
And performers in general. Like, there are just so many people doing stuff. I think it is legitimately the fact that we get the opportunities to develop ourselves slowly and well. Because I see this in opera a lot, that you get an awesome voice. Well, not a lot, but you see it in opera. And in music theatre, you get someone who is a gun singer and they come in and they're like, wow, whiz bang, shove them in a role, and they crash and burn because they've got no background, they've got no training, they've got nothing to back up their vocal technique with. It's just like this raw talent that then just gets absolutely shattered because they haven't got, you know, they haven't had those years of building up stamina or building up a knowledge of how to protect their voice and protect their body and protect their soul. You know, it's, so I think we Ballaratians.
Ballaratians.
Sorry. That's I like that. That's very posh. You can have it, yeah. Thank you, Ballaratians. You learn stamina. You learn how to pace yourself. You learn how to get through a show. Like, you know, you don't go out drinking. Well, sometimes you do, but, you know, if you want to do a good performance, you don't go out every night before an opening night. You know, you learn that discipline very early on.
Well, this is interesting, isn't it? Because the voice is your cash cow. It's your it's your survival. It's your career.
Uh-huh.
How do you look after it on a daily basis?
I think the big one for me that, I mean, I'm lucky because I've got cords of steel, as every ENT I've ever been to is like, you've got the most pristine chords of any opera singer I've ever seen, because we get them every time you feel a bit, you know, oh, my voice, you know, I've had a cold for a while, you go to an ENT and that, you just get checked out. But thank God I've never had anything go wrong. But the big thing that most of them say is don't talk over loud things. Like, don't talk all day over people speaking, don't talk over transport. Like, if you're walking down the street talking on the phone over buses and things, and you're just, you know, trying to talk loudly, don't talk at nightclubs, loud cafes and stuff. All of that everyday wear is really much more wearing than singing, because you're not using your proper technique, even though, and I'm not now, like, I should use proper technique every time I speak, but I just can't bring myself to do it because I sound like a wanker. And
I was reading about Renee Fleming the other day when she's in performance. She reports to be phone phobic and avoids using the phone around performance time because she says it pushes and tenses the voice, which fatigues it.
Yeah, it's the same thing if you're talking over. And I mean things like not being in smoky environments or, you know, polluted environments.
Is coffee bad for it, the voice?
Oh, probably, but I'm not giving that up. No. Hey, don't ask that.
At least you don't smoke. Yeah.
Oh, it's dehydrating, but
You must have to be super healthy because you are vocal Olympians, aren't you? You're vocal athletes.
I think a lot of it, I'm in two minds on this because, yes, you do have to. You can't go nuts. And I'm also lucky because things like dairy and stuff don't affect my voice. Some people get really affected with the word mucus. We talk about mucus a lot as opera singers. You kind of talk about it on the train, and you see civilians kind of looking at each other, rolling their eyes. But it's probably better than phlegm. Yeah, I know. We talk about all of our secretions and stuff all the time. We're repulsive, but some people get affected by that stuff, so they have to be a lot more careful. But things like, you know, alcohol, drying stuff, you know, just stuff that can affect your body badly. Anything that affects your body is going to affect your voice. Worse than food for me is exhaustion. If I'm really tired, I find that a lot tougher to get through a show than anything I, you know, ingest. But certainly, being fit helps your stamina. Like you can't get up there and do a 5-hour opera if you're totally just
unhealthy.
Yeah, as opposed to, you know, that popular, you know, misapprehension that opera singers are all totally unfit and huge, and you know, you can't get up there and sing for that long, and sound that good for that long if you haven't got some degree of fitness.
Are you exhausted at the end of a performance?
It usually takes me a while. I get nervous before every performance, every single time, whether it's 10 people in a lounge room or every time. But I stay high on adrenaline for at least an hour after a show, so I don't come straight down. But then I just suddenly will get home and go, and crash, and I'm troughing. Yeah, so I stay up for a while after the show, but then, yeah, when I crash, I crash.
So ballet dancers are at the bar every day, refining their technique.
Yes.
Do you practice singing every day?
No. Look, when you're singing a lot,
yeah,
basically, some people do.
Don't talk over that plane.
Yes. I don't, because whenever I'm actually actively singing, I'm thinking about my technique anyway. So, and I'll take away certain phrases of that and practice them. And rather than doing scales and things, I'm practicing various things on my voice, but constantly thinking about technical things until I hit the stage, and then all that stuff goes and it's just performance. But while I'm learning a role, I think about all that, which is basically the same as practice. So I don't do, but yes, I don't do specific exercises unless I need to. I might, if I'm warming up. I don't warm up much either. I'm a bit bad. I'm a bad example.
Bad
singer.
Opera singer. Bad singer.
I should warm up. I always remember, well, maybe it's been misattributed, but there was some quote from Joan that which is that if she's in good voice, she doesn't need to warm up, and if she's in bad voice, it doesn't make any difference.
Well, I guess as the individual performer, you know your body, you know your voice, you know what it needs.
Some people need to warm up a lot.
Yeah.
And I get that. And some roles I do. But not a huge amount, because I also think it can be counterproductive, especially if you're not feeling 100%, like if you're already a bit fatigued and you go and sing. And I've known a singer who does this. She would go in for 3 hours before an opera and she'd be sung out by the time she hit the stage. She'd just be wrecked by the time she got there. And that's craziness.
Well, there's those stories of Ethel Merman too, who apparently didn't warm up.
No.
She went in, got dressed out on the stage and gave this fabulous performance.
When I did Madame Butterfly with Jerry Hadley, who worked with her, and he's got some fabulous stories of her with Mary Martin who did warm up a lot.
Yeah.
And they were doing something at
Carnegie Hall or something. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
And they didn't have dressing rooms. They just had segmented, you know, things, and they could all hear each other, and she'd been warming up forever. And Ethel just like, screw out, save it, love, you haven't got that much left, you know. And yeah, there are some people who just don't, and I can imagine Ethel didn't need to.
She didn't need to.
Coughing a spit and she'd be out there.
Absolutely. Pipes of steel.
Yeah.
So as an opera singer, of course, you're singing in different languages.
Yes.
Are you a good linguist?
I am. No, I'm not going to say that.
No, please don't. No, and I didn't say it for that.
Well led. Yes, I'm kind of lucky that I've got a good ear. There are people better than me. I have a friend, Kath Carby, who is ridiculously good. Like, she will hear a language once and be fluent. She's
so how do you learn? Are you learning it phonetically, or do you actually have some understanding of what words mean?
Well, because I studied it first at College of the Arts, and then, I mean, I've worked in Austria, so my German's the best.
Can you converse in German?
I can to it. I could. I was fluent when I was there. Right. I wouldn't be now. But I'd get that back up fairly quickly. And Italian and French I've sung so much in that you really do get to know them, and I've studied them. And that you never feel like you know them that well until you do an opera in something like Russian or Czech and you don't know it much at all. And you're like, oh my God, I never realized how well I knew the other three languages until I did something like this, because that I did something in Russian and it was basically phonetic until I got a better feel for the language, and then it started to flow and I started to see words repeating. And but learning it in the first place, wow, I don't know how any opera singer could do it without having at least a decent grasp of the language, because my first teacher, who was a fabulous old Polish woman, Halinka Tatarzynska, always said, if you don't know exactly what you're singing, how can you make the audience understand it or feel anything? She said, you have to know every word, because how will you know where the emphasis should be? You cannot sing phonetically because you can't get a flow. You can't make it. You can't make someone's heart moved if you don't know what you're saying yourself.
And I'm sure and connecting to the text and yeah. having some feeling is yeah. what's going to move an audience.
Exactly.
That's what makes and the great singers and the mediocre
yeah.
singers.
If yeah. you're singing phonetic, I just don't get, and I know people do that and make it sound beautiful, but it's, I can't come at that because I need that connection. I need that, you know.
So I suppose you're singing in different sized theatres and halls mm-hmm. and things too. How do you calibrate your voice to fit the different size space?
I don't think you do. I think you just sing and trust. I think Melbourne's almost twice as big. Opera theatre in Sydney at the Opera House is quite small. So it's gorgeous. Like you can make a tiny little sound and it pings out to the back. And you can still do that in Melbourne as long as you do it with great technique. Like as long as you do it with cut and with... but I don't change my technique. Even when I was doing a musical, I don't change my technique. And I think that's where some people can get into trouble if they try to readjust their voice. I think you have to trust the conductor. If you're in a massive space and you're singing against a big orchestration, a good conductor will pull the orchestra down, whereas you wouldn't need to in a smaller space so much. And, you know, you might if the orchestra is massively loud. But I think if the team's working together, you just sing with your technique and they'll say, we need more, we need less, you know.
The conductor's giving signals as to what...
Yeah, the conductor
he's turning up the
gives
volume
very
turning
clear,
it down.
Very
yeah.
clear. No, he doesn't tend to do it like a tweak.
A knob? A knob?
No, it's usually, you know, hands up, hands down.
Yeah. Right.
But, yeah, they give you pretty clear instructions on whether... And you find out in rehearsals, too, if you need to give more juice or... and just how quiet you can be, you know. There are some venues where your piano in another venue is... You know, your mezzo forte in that venue, you know, you've got to bring it all up a bit because it's much bigger. But your technique stays the same, you know. You can just, you maybe change the basic volume a notch, but, you know, not too much.
I guess your performance rests a lot on the conductor and your relationship.
It does. It really does.
Establish. And that must be... sometimes if you've not worked with a conductor before,
yeah.
it's flying by the seat of your... flying by the seat of your pants, but you're not in that area of comfort or safety
of,
that
yeah,
you would
of knowing.
Feel.
Mm. And it's good if you're doing a big role that you've never done, knowing that you're going into it with someone you know and love and trust. But having said that, I've done roles, you know, big role debuts with people I've never worked with and loved it because there are very few conductors that I've had bad experiences with. I love them. I think I have so much respect for them because I haven't got a Bachelor of Music degree. So that degree of musicality, of knowing all those instruments and transposing instruments and reading 1,500 different clefs and being able to hear those textures, you know, just having that. There's another superstar from Ballarat, Ben Northey, who's conducting.
Oh,
amazing.
Yeah,
we're doing a Christmas concert together.
Wonderful.
But yeah, just the fact that they can hear those textures and pick what needs to be tweaked to get the perfect, you know, ensemble sound. I just have so much respect for that. So I think if you go into it with that attitude that we're all here to create something gorgeous together, they're on your side. Like, that's what they want too. So I think as long as you have that attitude, I don't think you ever really have a problem.
Yeah.
Like, you can get conductors who have a bit of a, you know, histrionic temperament, but you just let them go and they always come back, you know.
You've got an extensive CV, I must say.
I'm old, darling.
Well, I know how old, but yes. You're not that old. Kadisha, Madalena, Amelia, Flora, Suzuki, Dorabella. Far too many to mention here. But do you have a favourite role?
Oh, gosh. I loved singing. I sang composer in Ariadne auf Naxos with Victorian Opera, and which Richard Gill had trusted me. Like, he gave me that role. And I was kind of saying, I think I can probably sing it. Are you sure I can sing it? Which I said to Lyndon Terracini a time or two. You know, he said, I want you to sing that. And I'm like, are you sure? He's like, yep, you'll be right. And he was correct.
I guess that is why they're in those roles.
Yeah, they've heard voices.
They know, yeah.
Richard said, yes, I really want you to sing this. And it was an absolute turning point in my voice and my career. I started singing this Strauss massive, it's just these massive, gorgeous, long lines and really high. And suddenly my voice just opened up and sat. I suddenly thought, this is what I'm supposed to be singing. And that was when the kind of Verdi, Strauss, Wagner world opened up for me. I was like, oh, suddenly it just felt like I was opening my mouth and I was making no effort, but this sound was just pouring out. And that's, for me, that's perfect technique. When you're singing something that's right, it feels like you're doing nothing. It just feels like you're sitting above the sound, and it's gorgeous. It just pours out. And Richard actually sent me an SMS a couple of months ago saying that. He just said, look, Flossie, just wanted to let you know that composer was one of the pinnacles of my career. And I was like, oh God. but it was really special. So that was certainly one. Sound of Music every night was when I took Mother Abbess on, apart from the fact that they cut the line, which
the famous line, yes, or the infamous line,
they didn't trust me with it.
I wouldn't trust you either.
But that was when I first took it on. I thought, how am I going to make this fresh 8 times a week? Because I'd never done 8 shows a week, apart from our famous Godspell for 10/11 shows.
We did 1 week.
Yes. Yeah. But I never had to try, because it's such a brilliantly written show and brilliantly written music that I cried every night, didn't have to think about it. And of course was acting opposite Amy LaPalma, who was different every night and divine and wore a heart on her sleeve. So I was like, oh, we're right.
Did you get much knitting done? Because she's out for a couple of scenes and
she's
a lot of time in the dressing room.
She does a lot more.
What were you, in a German
musical
at the end, were you?
No, but I tried. Right. She does a lot more because she sings Favourite Things and stuff. She's on for a lot more time.
Yep.
But yeah, she does get a little chunk. But I was learning. What was I? Oh, I went straight into the Ring Cycle after that. So I was singing back the Ring Cycle.
Talk about versatile.
Yeah. I did my final Sound of Music in Adelaide on a Sunday matinee, and I started rehearsing the Ring. I sang in 3 of the 4 Ring operas on the Monday in Sydney. I had no break. It was insane.
Yes.
Yeah.
Never rains, but it pours.
Yeah, exactly.
So what about composers? Do you have a favourite composer that you like to sing?
Oh, Strauss and Wagner are kind of really my thing. They just sit. They're effortless. And Verdi I love. I sing it all right, but it doesn't give me the hoo-ha's, like, you know, the ooh. Strauss is probably... Yeah, Strauss and Wagner.
What about music theatre composers?
Well, obviously all the classic ones. I mean, it's funny because some of the things I'd love to sing, I won't sing because they're all the... I love belt shows too, you know. I love Les Mis. I remember seeing that was just, you know, groundbreaking for me. I bawled nonstop.
And Sondheim, of course.
Oh,
I remember
God,
you.
Sondheim, my God.
I remember hearing you do I Never Do Anything Twice was one of the first things
yes!
I heard you sing. Yeah,
of course. I'll have to sing that again.
You must sing that again.
I'd forgotten. Didn't I pull you into that somehow?
I believe so. And there was one night with your brother, and I forget who, but we did Invocation.
Oh,
and
Instructions. Instructions at the Encore Awards.
Yeah, it's in Ballarat.
In Ballarat.
Yeah.
We also did sections of Les Mis with the glorious... Who do we have? Simon Maiden.
That's right.
Singing Gavroche.
Simon, who's about to open in Come From Away.
In
Melbourne, which is fantastic.
He's a superstar.
Yeah.
I still... Simon, if you're listening, and Peter and everyone, I still have that on DVD. I've been threatening for years to pull that out.
Oh, the...
I have Invocation and I have the Les Mis highlights.
Moving along, Jackie. Thank you. That's great. I've forgotten what I was going to say now, but very good.
So you're wonderful.
You moved into musical theatre, of course.
Yes.
But you were doing a lot of that before your opera career took off. I think you did things like My Fair Lady and...
Yep.
Had you done a Sweeney Todd?
I did ensemble of Sweeney Todd with OA. When I the first year I came to OA, I was singing in Vienna, and Simone Young was conducting something there and asked to hear me sing. So I sang in a room for her, and she asked if I'd come back and be a young artist. And I said yes, because it was interesting because there were some kind of contracts coming up in Germany, but I was incredibly homesick and I'm a real homebody. So I wanted to come home, and it was my first time away from home, really. So, hopped home.
Distracted
and,
by the neighbours.
Yes, distracted
singing
by
out
the neighbours. I'm loving it.
I love it. This is the best interview I've done. Planes, children, neighbours.
Oh, no distractions. I came back and
4D experience.
Yeah, and they had, you know, allocated me some roles. I did some awesome stuff that first. You know, I did the title role in Iolanthe. I was in Lindy Chamberlain, the opera.
Yes, I read it on the fish and chip papers.
Oh my God, yes.
That
on the fish and chips. Oh, it was awesome. And
That's interesting too. What's it like to do new works like that and also really absurdist pieces like The Nose?
Brilliant.
You know, that Stravinsky
I love it.
Is it more challenging? I hate
learning them because they're so hard.
Right.
But I love doing them in the end because they're just, I mean, you know my personality. I'm a bit quirky anyway. So I just love that off-kilter, off-centre, and I love surprising an audience. And like our cabaret, I just like, you know, kind of doing 180s and I love pieces that do that. And modern works that no one's heard. People don't know what to expect, and it's great giving something life for the first time. It's awesome.
Well, watching you too, I think, you know, what stands you in good stead is you are a very versatile performer.
Yeah.
You can swing between a lot of different forms, which is fantastic.
It has been a blessing,
But Sound of Music, you know, you're crowned with a role which has been adopted by a lot of great Australian singers like June Bronhill, Racina Resbeck, and Eileen Hannon. Was it daunting to daunting to take on the role of Mother of Bess?
Of course. I was very lucky that there was an incredible team, and Gavin, our director, was amazing. And I and the producers were amazing, and our musical team, you know, we had Luke and Peter, we had Matt, and everyone was working together to create the best thing they could. And I was, you know, I wasn't used to doing, I hadn't done spoken dialogue for a while. So, you know, I'd worked on that, and I was talking to the director about that, and he had suggestions about how I could maybe tweak bits of that. And I'm using the word tweak far too much. That's not a word I use regularly, but you brought it out in me, Pete.
I'm sorry.
No, it's great. And so I was kind of doing the best I could, and then letting them mold me within what was kind of my performance anyway. So I was really lucky that they had ideas, plus they let me bring myself to it, if that makes sense. That, you know, it wasn't a cookie cutter thing. They really looked at the individual personalities and let us be ourselves, but then helped us be better. And it was a beautiful team and a beautiful cast. And I was really, we were all so lucky just to have that behind us. And they were constantly affirming that we're so lucky to have this cast. So all of those apprehensions we had about, are we going to be compared to everyone? That helped, because they kept saying, we're really happy with you guys.
You're able to be your brand new production.
Yeah, yeah.
A new revival.
Yeah, don't be anyone else, be yourselves.
So how does the routine of appearing in musical theatre differ from opera? Because, you know, you're doing eight shows a week in opera. You're doing one, every second, third night, fourth night?
Two or three a week.
Yeah.
Unless you were, like back when we were ensemble at Opera Australia, we would do a lot more than that. But that's not a usual thing. I think it's a very different discipline. In opera, you're unamplified, so you basically have to give not a pristine, but a very, very high quality, you know, note perfect very good vocal performance every time, unamplified, and that takes a lot of energy, that takes a lot of physical, you know, physicality. And you do that for 3 or 4 hours, and then you rest for a couple of days. So music theatre, you're amplified. So if you're feeling a bit low, like if you're feeling a bit, you've got a bit of a cold, whatever, you can trust the sound techs. They can say, you know, you don't need to sing out. Mind you, I kind of didn't subscribe to that as much, because if I'm singing, I'm just singing with my technique. So, you know, I didn't change much, but you did have that option to, you know, you don't have to project into a 2000 seat theatre using nothing but your body. You know, you have got the weight of technology behind you. But it's certainly a different thing. You learn to pace yourself a lot more. I didn't go out basically at all, but, you know, I was
Well, a lot of people say that, a lot of music theatre performers saying it's very much a monastic experience.
It is.
You do the show and then you go home and you rest. And,
And so many people who do leads in music theatre are so, like Amy, one of the most extraordinarily disciplined humans. You know, she'll have days where she doesn't talk to protect her voice. If she's doing a lot of, you know, we had weekends where we had 4-show weekends. So you don't really want to be making a lot of vocal sacrifices on top of that, you know. So it's that discipline of just, but also, as you said before, knowing your voice and knowing how much you can do and how much you can't do. But there are opera singers like that too, that can be, there's a lot of sacrifice in that too. If you're singing those big Wagner roles, I know people will say, like gorgeous Stuart Skelton, who's now, you know, conquering the world in those roles, always says, all right, I give up. You know, he loves his Negronis. I think he has these amazing, you know, cocktails he creates, but he's like, you know, X number of days before rehearsals start, he stops and he does not have anything. You know, he is a temple for that period of, you know, and it's just an incredible discipline. It's like, okay, I love these things, but I can't do these two things together and do this to the highest of my ability. So that has to go. I think in an opera, you need to vocally pace yourself more. And I think in music theatre, you need to physically pace yourself all the time, for your whole life more.
Would you like to do more musical theatre?
I would. I can't tour as much now, which is a pity, because there were some gorgeous things I could have obviously auditioned for or gone for, but I can't so much. My little boy's 6, so he's in school now, so I can't do the touring as much.
So let's talk about that then. That's a good segue. You became a mum quite late.
Yes.
The desire for parenthood must have been quite powerful.
It was. I'd always wanted to have kids, and I was, because I'm also a scientist, I was obviously reading about the medical facts of the thing, which is the older I got, the less chance I had. And I got to a point where I thought I just had to. I was single, and I just thought I just had to do this. So I went out and just did it. And so I was. I've not regretted it for a second, even though it's a tough road. Like being a single mum and trying to do this career. He was, I think, when I went on Sound of Music, he was 2 to 4. So it was tough. You know, I had to find daycare in different cities for days I was rehearsing, and get babysitting at night for every night that I was on. And it was really tough. And I'm incredibly lucky that I've got my best friend, Kanan Breen, who is wonderfully supportive, but he does this career too. So he's gone for long periods at a stretch. And, you know, when he's here, he's amazing, and they adore each other. But essentially it's my responsibility, and I wouldn't be without him, because he's
gorgeous.
The absolute light of my life. He's just, and Kane says that too, like they are so in love with each other, and you know it's beautiful to watch that as well, that how much it's enriched his life too. It's given us both a lot of perspective. You know, you can have a bad show, or you know, have a bum note and come home and go, oh, well, cuddles.
And
really,
all is right with the
Yeah, boy. Yeah. It's,
has it changed, motherhood changed you as a performer, do you think?
I think so.
And in what way?
I remember when I used to sing Madame Butterfly, I always got really emotional at the point where she gave the baby away, or gave the baby and knew that you knew she wasn't going to see him again. And I don't think I could do it now. I just don't think. Wow. Like, yeah. Before I had kids, I would sob. And yeah. now I just think, oh, my God, it's just like...
so much more empathy, yeah. so much more understanding.
It's
yeah.
just... And I remember there'd be nights during Sound of Music when I got to that Act One finale of Climb Every Mountain and be looking out into the audience. And it was... I don't know what it was in my brain there, because, of course, I missed tucking him in at night. That's the other thing with music theatre. You're not home at nights. So I missed reading him bedtime stories for a while. I missed tucking him in. And sometimes I'd be halfway through the end of that song, you know, A Dream That Will Need All the Love You Can Give, and his face would just pop up and I'd be like, oh my God, and my whole body would just like, and it would take the whole song to another level. And it just, you know, some nights I'd just be singing to him, and you know, it really does change perspectives, and it does give you a much deeper. And people will say, when you're pregnant, you get very emotional. You cry at RTA ads and you know, all that stuff and anything to do with kids. And it doesn't go away. I thought it would post-hormonal, you know, it would go. It never does. You're always more emotionally sensitive. Well, I am. I mean, and people I've spoken to seem to have the same experience. But it's like, oh, man, everything makes me cry. Now it was bad enough before.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's talk about when you were pregnant. How was your voice affected at all?
No, mine, I mean, it got a bit bigger and bizarrely higher. I was told it would get bigger and lower. It got bigger and higher. So I was doing, when I found out I was pregnant, I was doing Don Giovanni. So I did two seasons of that. And poor Teddy Tahoe Rhodes and Shane Laurentiev, who were two of my Don G's, like, were throwing me to the ground and kneeling on me and wrestling me. And I couldn't tell anyone because I was early pregnancy. And they were coming up going, oh, I had no idea, Jax. Oh, my God, the things I did to you. And I'm like, oh, yeah. And I just said I would have told you if... and then after that was Mozart. I used to sing Mozart to put him to sleep because he knew it. And then I did the Benedict Andrew Marriage of Figaro with Opera Australia. And I was, I think, nearly 8 months pregnant. So they put me in this big... I was the mum, so it was hilarious. I just looked like a tent. But he's a big fan of having things fall from the ceiling. So there was a... He had like confetti all over the floor and I was meant to run on the stage and it was so slippery. And I think it kind of became a run walk because it was...
You had to be careful.
I know. And that was when I had to actually admit I was pregnant because there was a point where he wanted someone to push me roughly, yeah. Roger, to the stage. And I ended up having to say, look, can I just do it more gently? And he said, no, I want it to be really... I'm like, oh, maybe not. Yeah. So I had to kind of... go up and say, look, this is why I'm not precious, but yeah, maybe not.
I'm having a baby.
Yeah.
Now, Jack, the last 12 months have certainly presented their challenges to you. There's been a few low points.
Yeah.
How, as a performer, do you remain positive and look forward to the future and securing more work?
Yeah, look, I think any performer has their low points. We all do in this industry, and I think it's all about how you deal with them. And I honestly think if there was anything else, like I say, they always say, what advice do you have for young singers? I'm like, if you're happy doing anything else, do it, because this is a really tough career. But I'm not, this is who I am. It's not just something I do. It's me. And so I think you then have two choices, and one is to wallow and, you know, feel sorry for yourself, and that just makes everyone around you miserable and doesn't do you any favours. Or you reinvent yourself and find your own opportunities and make your own opportunities, which is hopefully what I've done my fair share of wallowing, don't get me wrong. And those around will attest to that. But I think I had, you know, I had a right to have a bit of wallow over a few situations. But I also think, looking back, there are things that I have lost, but they've led to me doing things I wouldn't have been able to do otherwise.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it.
Things have come up to fill voids that...
When a window closes, yeah, a door opens.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Hang on, Auntie Mame. Yeah. Open a new... it's... I did Rufus Wainwright's opera Prima Donna.
Oh, Prima Donna. How was that?
I did the lead role in that at Adelaide Festival. I mean, it's a soprano role. And Neil Armfield just came up to me and gave me a score in a plastic. It was like this illicit, you know, this paper bag with, he's like, have a look at this and see if you could sing it. And I looked at it and I thought, oh, top C's. Yeah, look. And I had a crack and I took a few days. He said, take some days. And I went back and I said, yeah, I think I can. He didn't tell me what it was.
Because I remember seeing a documentary when Rufus Wainwright first did it. So was that only the second production?
Was the first in Australia. I'd love to do it again because it's a genius role. I love the role. It's just, I loved it so much. And I wouldn't have got to do that. And I did it with Rufus and he sat in every rehearsal and was giving me personal notes and every rehearsal we had. And then the second half of the program was him doing his Judy Garland show. So I got to rip off my costume and race upstairs and they had a bottle of champagne for me and a seat. And we just sat there and watched him. And it was the most extraordinary experience. And that's something I wouldn't have got to do. You know, Black Rider, the Tom Waits opera with Victorian Opera, which was, you know, that cast, you know, Paul Capsis, Kanan Breen, Meow Meow, Gato Chocolat, Richard Piper, Dimity Shepherd. Have I forgotten anyone?
Jack, I'm going to have to vacuum the carpet after.
Oh, I know.
After we finish because of the dropping names all the names.
I know, but that show, but it's that true. Cast. It's real. Oh my God. It's like, oh yes, Winston. Yes, of course. But it was the most extraordinary cast to get together. And that's something else I wouldn't have had the chance to do. And then Kane and I have created this cabaret called Strange Bedfellows. And we've written a few shows. We're not those prolific cabaret performers who just write a show every year or every 6 months. When we've got something to say, we write one. So we're on our fourth show now, which is a Christmas show that will be appearing before you this December. So please come.
Remembering that we're listening to this next year, 2019. So it was a really great show.
Yes, cut that. Yes.
And a lot of people went.
Yes. Mm. So, well, hopefully. So we've created that cabaret. So we're getting some mileage out of that. And I'm just trying to think of other, just things have come up that...
So there are positives.
Yeah. And the other thing, I mean, I did a gig with the Australian Ballet, which was incredible. I got to sing with the Australian Ballet in their Murphy tribute recently and last year. And that was extraordinary. And getting to work with... Because while I was full-time with Opera Australia... You don't really, you know, the other companies stop asking for you because you're never available. But now, you know, I've worked in Queensland and South Australia and I've worked for the Oz Ballet.
So
and
you've
Victoria.
Got a degree of freedom. You're a bit sort of freelance.
It's positives and negatives because you don't have a regular income. But the things I'm doing are just so exciting and so much fun. You know, I've worked with two ensembles this year. We wrote a Strange Bedfellows show with... Jess Wells, who's an incredible composer and performed with Plexus Ensemble, who are this whiz-bang modern classical ensemble. And I did this other piece at Melbourne Recital with Syzygy Ensemble, who are another gun modern classical instrumental. Incredible stuff. And again, really difficult music, but I think I can sing anything now after learning some of those pieces. Just some of the things... I'm trying to teach my little boy. One thing I say to him a lot when he's whinging about me saying no is you've got to look at the things you've got, not at the things you haven't got. Because if you keep looking at the things you haven't got, you're never going to be happy.
No, you're not. No.
You know, you have to look at the things you've got and really cherish them and make the most of them. And, you know, the things you don't have, you'll forget about or they'll fall by the wayside. But grab the things you've got with both hands and use them and keep going. And I think that's the secret to it all, really. Does that sound too naff?
No, it's absolutely... I think so. I mean, as long as I've known you, you've always been an incredibly positive person. You've always had a smile and a laugh.
Yeah. Oh, it did stop for a little while, but not long.
Well, I hope that it may long continue.
I do too.
Darling, thank you so much for this conversation with Stages today.
It has been my absolute pleasure.
Yeah.
And to see you again.
Oh, yeah. After, you know, we kept putting it off. But
yes.
I'm glad, yes, that we're here and we're doing this.
Me too. Yeah.